It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest offers advice and policy changes to help low-income people save for financial emergencies.
First, Wisconsin's been in the national headlines this week because of a controversy over appropriate behavior at school sporting events.
The Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletics Association sent out an email to schools last month listing chants that it saw as inappropriate or that taunted opposing teams and fans.
Fast forward to this last week, the story gained traction after a high school athlete was suspended for 5 games after tweeting her disapproval of the WIAA's suggestions with strong language.
Joining us now to talk more about this increased attention on sportsmanship at school athletic events is Jim Langkamp, athletic director for the Baraboo School District. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate and enjoy public radio, so it's a pleasure to be on.
Oh, thank you. Well, in WIAA's original email, it said that there was an increase in this kind of taunting chant and that it was something that needed to be curbed right away. That's the first email. They walked that back a bit later. But in your work, have you noticed that there is an increase like that?
Personally, I have not. You're right. In the email, they had mentioned that in their fall season tournament series, they had seen an increase in chants. But, you know, locally here in Baraboo, and I was able to get to games on the road as well, and I don't know that I noticed any difference, you know, last fall to a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago even.
Well, let's be clear. Now, when we're talking about the chants that the WIAA was concerned about, what sorts of things did they want people to stop saying?
Their general message was basically that you know, any cheers directed at the other, at the opponents or the opponent's fans, anything that was intended to taunt or disrespect, were specifically mentioned. You know, the general advice really was that you know, we want our students and our fans to cheer for our own team and cheer loud and proud, but you know, again, the cheers directed toward the other side more often than not are not sportsmanlike.
How big a part of the athletic event as a whole are cheers like that? Things like air ball or fundamentals at a basketball game. How big a deal is it to the fans who go?
I'm not. You know, I would just say, just in a general sense, you know, the students and the student bodies are really what make high school sports special. The energy that they bring and. You know, you get bands and cheerleaders and dance groups and all of that, and it's what makes high school sports, you know, again, much more special than professional sports or often even college sports. You know, in terms of what the place that the chants hold at a game, in general, you know, there's always going to be some level of that type of thing. Again, whether, you know, an air ball type chant or you know, fans getting upset about a call or something like that, and it's part of just the emotion of the game as well. I think when that becomes the focus, though, is, you know, you always want the focus to be on the court or on the field, and, you know, you want that to be where the attention is. I think sometimes when, you know, and I've been to some sporting events where you have one student group trying to, you know, be out clever the other side and, you know, and say something you know, derogatory or you know, inflammatory along those lines, then that's, to me, that's when it gets out of control, is when that becomes the focus and that's what people walk away from. Then that becomes a problem. But again, just in the course of a game, again, some of the cheers that you mentioned, if it's an occasional type thing, I don't know that most people have a problem with that.
Well, what was your first reaction to that email from the WIAA? Did you think, yeah, they're onto something, this is a problem, or was it something that wasn't as big an issue as to warrant an email like that?
Just locally, you know, I interpreted it as a friendly reminder. You know, I read through the email and again took it as a reminder. Our students, you know, this, I think we've had a great winter season. So personally, I deleted it. And again, just took it under advisement and as something to keep an eye on. But I certainly didn't view it as that this was something new or something that I, you know, needed to broadcast out, you know, to the students or parents in our community or anything like that. So no, I just, again, I took it as a friendly reminder as we started to hit the midpoint of the winter season that, again, we're always looking for ways to improve sportsmanship and run first class high school sporting events. And to me, that's exactly what it was. I certainly didn't see this as a new day or a new directive coming from on high.
We're talking to Jim Langkamp right now, athletic director for the Baraboo School District, talking about the recent controversy over what student behavior at sporting events should be like. And Jim, not everybody took it the way you did. Some people did feel that there was a bit of a gag effect going on. There's a picture in the New York Times of students with duct tape over their mouths protesting. What do you think of that reaction?
It depends, I guess, on what message they received, you know, whether it's, you know, from their own school or not. In this case, I believe there was a misunderstanding and overreaction. We just had a meeting Wednesday with our conference athletic directors, and we discussed this for a little bit. And again, the 14 athletic directors around the table all kind of viewed it, you know, the same as again, nobody sent this out to their student body and said, hey, we got to change what we're doing. In terms of the reaction at other places, I'm not sure what message they received. I do know some of the headlines and things like that that have gone on, in the media, I don't think were necessarily accurate with, again, what the message truly was.
Now, some students and fans have said that chants like airball, again, and fundamentals that were listed as things that weren't very sportsmanlike in that email, that they're not that bad. Is it hard, do you think, for fans to draw the line between chants that are okay and chants that are not?
I think it is hard. I've always thought, you know, one of the challenges we have, you know, and especially those of us kind of in the Madison area, is, you know, when you go to, for example, a UW sporting event and see and hear what those students chant, and then as a high schooler, they come back to our schools and sometimes we'll think, oh, that was cute, that was clever, that was funny, and so let's do that at our games. I think certainly that makes things a little challenging for us. And some of it's just long tradition and history. And like you said, you know, the airball cheer has been around, obviously, for decades. And I think, again, it's one of those things that in a singular episode isn't really a big deal. For example, the airball cheer, I know as a conference a couple of years ago, we talked about that and said, if an airball happens and students chant airball for a couple of seconds immediately after the play, probably no big deal. But it's the kind of thing that if every time that same player gets the ball, the student body's chanting air ball and, you know, kind of singling out a player, then that's where it crosses the line. So again, an isolated incident, the air ball cheer and things like that aren't necessarily in and of themselves that out of control, but it's it depends on the situation and how long it's allowed to go on and is it directed at a specific player and things like that.
Again, these are high school sports we're talking about, but some people have looked at this story and said, this is another example of adults trying to coddle kids today. Do you think that's a fair complaint?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a case of, again, those of us in high school athletics, you know, we every year, you know, you're striving to improve your sportsmanship and improve your, you know, just the way that your events are viewed within your community, and it's been that way for a long time. You know, ever since I've been in the business, where again you have those discussions every year, and what can we do better, and how can we get better. So no, I don't think it's a matter of that we don't want to hurt kids' feelings or things like that. I think it's about being first class and putting on a positive reflection. Because as athletic directors and other school officials, we do hear and we do get complaints if a student body is not acting the right way. We'll hear about it. People take to Twitter or Facebook and say, wow, boy, I was at such and such high school last night and their fans were awful. None of us also want to paint our high school in that that picture as well. So I think individually, schools were always trying to make sure that we're doing things the right way, because again, we don't want to be the ones singled out for being the group that's classless and unsportsmanlike.
Jim, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
That was Jim Langkamp, athletic director for the Baraboo School District, talking about the recent controversy over student behavior at sporting events.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
There's been a big emphasis on financial planning and financial literacy in recent years here in Wisconsin and around the country. People are encouraged to save for retirement, for education expenses, and for financial emergencies like the loss of a job.
But those kinds of savings can be hard to build up for people living on lower incomes, where day-to-day expenses and monthly bills take priority over savings, and unexpected costs like car repair or health care expenses can lead to financial crisis.
J. Michael Collins joins us now to talk about emergency savings for low-income people. He's Associate Professor of Public Affairs and Consumer Science at the UW-Madison, where he directs the Center for Financial Security. He's the editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, Emergency Savings and Liquid Resources for Low-Income Consumers. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as a society, Michael, and as policymakers maybe, have we paid much attention to this issue of emergency savings for people living on low income?
You know, we hear an awful lot about savings for retirement, savings for a house, savings for lots of things, but not much attention on this issue of unrestricted savings for an emergency, for a healthcare expense, for a loss of income.
So to the extent we have data, how many low-income people have reasonable emergency financial cushions available to them?
Well, the truth is even among middle-income people, there's a scarcity of these cushions. So it's about a third of low-income people who are saving for an emergency. About half of us overall are saving for an emergency. So it's lower than the average. The problem is most of us, when you ask how much do you need, we only have about half of what we think we need. So everyone's sort of struggling in this area, but it's even harder when you're low income.
Yeah, at this at a low income level, again, you're probably living day to day, month to month in a lot of ways. So what are the consequences for people in that situation and not having any or enough of that financial cushion?
Well, there's two problems that come up. One is you have a drop in income, like you didn't get the hours that you thought you might get, or you don't get the overtime. The other is you have an expense that you weren't prepared for. And those expenses sometimes aren't things you can put off. It might be rent, or it might be the car that you need to get to work. And so you end up borrowing. Sometimes you borrow from friends and family. Sometimes you borrow it at high cost. And in some cases, we see people who overdraft or they get into other kinds of trouble.
Right. It's kind of emergency management. So a payday lender possibly, or I think in your book you mentioned one way of managing is to put off bills, which can result in high fees, high penalties. So it's in a way, it's very costly to be poor.
It is.
In this situation.
And the truth is sometimes even the savings accounts are expensive because there's a minimum balance, there's a monthly fee. And so if you don't keep enough in these accounts, you don't use them regularly, those can be expensive to maintain too.
So to what extent is this an issue of financial literacy, people not saving, I guess, in a nutshell, as opposed to people not having enough resources to save money in the first place?
It's a little bit of both, but when you talk to folks, if you ask them about what their financial goals are, a number one goal is always being prepared for an emergency. People want to be independent and they want to be resilient. And so this is one that people know they need to do, and they either can't because they don't have the resources or because it's hard to come up with an account that works for them.
Right. So to the extent that people in low-income situations have this, I mean, you mentioned a bank account might have fees that make it impossible or hard to do this. People, I guess, just saving cash around the house is a possibility.
Cash is a possibility. And it's also, we find a lot of informal networks. So it's my family. When I'm in trouble, I'll borrow from other people in my family. When they're in trouble, they borrow from me. And sort of we find these informal ways to help each other out.
And at these income levels, I want to kind of hammer this home, emergency, you know, might be something that's an inconvenience to someone else. Oh, I've got to pay to get my car fixed. That's a bummer. But if you can't pay for that, not only can you not get the car fixed, the car is the way you get to work. It's a snowball effect.
It's a snowball effect. And so, you know, whereas we might have a credit card or some other way to make these things work, for some families, it's a tough choice between, you know, rent or food or a car repair. And so sometimes that's a tough choice that has to be made.
Talking about emergency savings for low-income people, we have J. Michael Collins with us. He's the editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, and he's with the UW-Madison. So let's talk about what could be done about this. First, let's start with the financial literacy side of things. What kind of help might there be to help low-income people come up with a plan to save those resources for a financial emergency?
Yeah, and the truth is most people know that these emergencies can happen. They just are overly optimistic about they're not going to happen tomorrow. And they could happen tomorrow. And so part of this is just helping people become more realistic about what an emergency costs and that it could happen and what are they going to do in those kinds of cases. So it's a little bit of planning ahead. ahead. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort for people to think about this, but it's not something we want to think about because these are bad events, and so we don't want to think about that. The next is to try to come up with an account that works for them. And like you said, it might be a bank account or it might be something else. But trying to find a way that we can put money aside in a way that is efficient is a key.
Now, your book consists of some laying out the basic problem and then a lot of different policy suggestions, personal suggestions from a lot of different people, actually. And I want to get into some of those now. First of all, let's talk about access to some kind of financial vehicle that doesn't have prohibitive fees, that is accessible, that is liquid, I guess is the word. Right. People can access those resources when they need them. What kind of things could be helpful, maybe at a federal level, or that financial institutions or communities could offer?
You know, some financial institutions are aware of the fact that they need these basic accounts. And so they come up with an account with barely any fees or very, very low fees, and they're pretty accessible. The trouble is that they're not well known, and so people don't know that those accounts exist. There are some exciting things happening at the federal level. Like there's this new MyRA product that has become available to the U.S. Treasury. It's designed to save for retirement, but there's no penalty from withdrawing early. So if you need that money, that could be a liquid source of resources as well.
Now, high-interest lenders, payday lenders, auto title loans, things like that, a lot of controversy in Wisconsin and everywhere else for that matter over the years. But one common defense for them is, if you take that away, that's it. There's no other credit alternative out there except, I've heard people say, except you know, a loan shark in right. your neighborhood or something like that. So could we kind of move past that controversy if there are better, less expensive vehicles for savings?
Yeah, and we talk about that a little bit in the book, too. We have some practitioners who've experimented with small-dollar loans, and they try to come up with a loan that they could charge an interest rate that's a little bit more reasonable. They are risky loans, less than you might see from a high-cost payday lender. And they've had reasonably good success. The problem is getting them marketed. You know, we don't have that sort of infrastructure to get a product like this out to scale.
Well, from a policy perspective, and I think you mentioned this in the book, you need not just something that's going to work for people, something that people also can find, and something that financial institutions of one sort or another are going to buy into and actually want to do and want to provide and publicize to the people who need them.
That's right. And I'm sympathetic for financial institutions because these small accounts can be expensive to run. People might need a lot of help. They might actually bring negative balance, and so they could be expensive. And so finding a way for institutions to do this in a safe place, and that's a combination of policy and regulation, so that they can do some experimentation and they can try to come up with a business model that works for them.
So that's banks and credit unions. You also look into the ideas, different possible approaches from tax incentive perspectives, credits, deductions, maybe not so useful. Can you lay out what's out there?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we have a lot of tax incentives for people to save for retirement, for a house, for education, and almost nothing for unrestricted savings that could actually help people avoid hardships in the long run. So trying to figure out more ways to provide incentives for these, you know, relatively small accounts, maybe up to $1,000 or $1,500 that people could put aside and get some sort of tax benefit from. That could be in the form of a tax credit. That's been an experiment that's floated by policymakers for a while for a small dollar tax credit for some amount of savings. And in fact, the most recent budget that was put out by OMB in the White House, and this just this week in the State of the Union, included an emergency assistance provision. So it's an idea that's got a little bit of purchase now at the federal level.
Really? I didn't know that. I should have read the State of the Union a little more closely.
It was actually quite buried.
And they buried that one.
It got picked up just a couple of resources. But it was a relatively like $2 billion set aside to try to do some experiments around emergency assistance.
Another thing you're hoping for in the book is that, okay, some things could happen at the federal level, but communities could really take the lead on something like this. So what kind of things are happening? Are there places that are tackling this problem?
It actually is an exciting field because most of the energy and enthusiasm is at the local level. Mm-hmm. It's local and city and partnerships between nonprofits and credit unions or financial institutions at the local level that's doing a lot of the exciting work. You know, example we have in the book is a organization that provides housing in it for low-income people. And they're essentially holding back $10 or $15 of every rent check to go into an escrow account so that if an emergency comes up, that family will have built up over the course of a couple of years several hundred dollars that they can use in case that happens. So there's lots of examples like that we have in the book of these partnerships that have developed that actually show some real promise.
So they might be working, there might be excitement at a local level, but that just helps that local level. Are there things you see out there that are promising that could be scaled, that could be lent to another community that could work in places other than the place it was born.
I think so. I think, you know, the key is to try to come up with more of these programs that can be integrated into a common program. So, you know, we have food assistance in most states. We have health care assistance in most states. We have other kinds of programs. And to try to marry these into those programs as much as we can. Housing is a great example. And it, obviously, many of our lenders today are regional or national in scope. And so to the extent we can create these kind of partnerships with financial institutions, they really could take them to a broader scale.
As we wrap up, you came out with this book over the last year. You've been working on these issues for longer than that. Do you see people, policymakers, community leaders, starting to pay more attention to this issue of emergency savings for low-income consumers?
Especially in the last year, I think we've really started to see more and more of that because we know that one of the things that keeps people out of really not just poverty but real hardship of losing a house or of a real cutback is having this cushion in place. And so it's a tough issue to tackle from a federal level, but certainly we know that this is the kind of thing that can help people's finances be better off.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Appreciate it.
That was J. Michael Collins. He's director of the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison. He's editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, Emergency Savings and Liquid Resources for Low-Income Consumers.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A cooking legend is coming to Milwaukee on Saturday, Lydia Bastianich. In addition to her Emmy Award-winning public television program, she's the owner of several restaurants, including Italy, Felidia, Beko, and more.
She's also the author of 10 cookbooks. The newest is called Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Great Italian Cook. Lydia's with us now to talk about the book and her event in Milwaukee tomorrow.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about cooking Italian food? What's your favorite Italian dish to make? And if you have some Italian in your background, what do you go to? Do you have those old family recipes that you turn to? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lydia Bastianich is host of Lydia's Italy on PBS. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Buongiorno, Rob and Veronica.
Well, this is your 10th cookbook. What sets this one apart from the others you've written before?
This one, it's special in a sense that it has a collection of things that I want to leave for my family as my life in cooking. I've been cooking for 40 years, and along the way, I learned a lot. There were a lot of people that shared with me tips, ideas, recipes, and I collected and I store these things. Some of these things I stored in my mind, some in the computer, some in the folder. Well, it was time to kind of pull out that folder. And it took me 3 years, actually, to pull it all together with the help of my daughter, Tanya. And it has kind of my heart, soul, my philosophy of food. It has more than 400 recipes. It has a glossary in the back, an extensive glossary. It has all the things that I think I wanted to tell and leave in somebody's reference library in the kitchen. It's a book that I hope will transcend generations and families, and it's done with lots of love.
So this was a cookbook that was written with your daughter, and you also said it's a lot of what you wanted to pass on. Does that mean there's a lot of family in this recipe book?
Well, there is the philosophy. You know, it doesn't mean that yes, it is. It's recipes that we love as family. It is stories about family. It is stories how I evolved in cooking, you know, and that takes me back to my grandmother's garden and animals and how I work with her. And I have developed this kind of connection to food. And it takes me up to the present, you know, the immigration process, the coming to America, then with my children, growing them in the restaurant business, sending them off to not want to do this, and ultimately they both came back and work with me. So it's a whole kind of, it's a biographical trip through food recipes, techniques. I think that's more important. You know, I weed in some stories and kind of the my life in cooking, but there's a lot of techniques. I address a lot of maybe vegetables and fruits that are not used, that are Italian, that are not used much. So I kind of want to make it easier for the cook. How to clean an artichoke? What are cardoons? How can I substitute one fish for another in one of those recipes? I don't know. It's I can go on and on. It's techniques. I talk all about the techniques of baking, roasting, steaming, dry roasting, wet roasting, and what's better for what. You know, a simple thing like the oven. And, you know, I want to bring the common sense in a lot of people as far as, you know, a lot of people know a lot about food, but they think they don't. You know, like the oven, the different parts of the oven, the middle, of course, roasts well. The top, if you want everything nice and crispy. On the bottom, you put your roast, if you have too much gravy and you want to dense it up. Simple things like that, and yet I think, you know, it's a message that really kind of eases people into cooking.
Talking to Lydia Bastianich. She is on her way to Milwaukee tomorrow. Her new cookbook is Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine. We're going to get into those techniques in a bit, Lydia, but I wanted to ask, you know, for everybody, food is part of who we are, and it seems like for you, food and cooking is a huge part of who you are. How did you develop this passion for cooking?
Yeah, well, I share part of that. Well, you know, Rob, I guess I have to go a little bit into the history I was born in an area, Istria. Istria is a little peninsula. So if you look at Italy, in the right-hand side corner, Italy has 20 regions. It's Friuli Venezia Giulia. And that region also had Istria in part of Dalmatia. But after World War II, Italy lost the war, and Istria was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. Now, I was born in Pola then, now Pula, Istria. And now, when I go back, it is Croatia. But as I was just born after World War II, and we got caught behind the Iron Curtain in communist Yugoslavia. And there, life kind of had changed drastically, you know, because we couldn't speak Italian, we couldn't go to church, and my mother was a teacher, and she was kind of watched. So my mother set my brother and myself with Grandma in a little town outside, and Grandma had this idyllic, you know, I still go back to that courtyard. She had a courtyard, and in this courtyard, you know, there were her sister and Grandpa's sister, and so the whole family was around, but also you went a little bit into the woods, and there were the pens, the animal pens. We had chickens, we had ducks, we had rabbits, we had pigs, we had goats. And then, of course, on the other side was the whole garden, and, you know, the seasonality of the garden. I helped with that, you know, from the gathering the peas, the beans, the ripe figs, to the potatoes. We even harvested wheat. They grew wheat, and we went to the mill for our flour. Grandma and Grandpa made olive oil, wine. So I grew up like a little runner for Grandma and Grandpa in this beautiful setting of food. You know, potatoes. I would help her harvest the potatoes, and I can still feel it warm from the earth, you know, because the earth under the sun gets nice and warm in the potatoes. So these kind of bread just freshly made bread dunked in the oil still running down when they were pressing it. So, you know, that's where I got my kind of reference library of flavors and passion and understanding of food. But then, you know, the idyllic situations always change. About 10 years later, my parents decided that, you know, they could no longer raise us under those conditions. And we literally escaped back into Italy. Now, my mother, my brother, and I, they allowed us, but they wouldn't allow the whole family, and my father had to escape. We all met in Italy, and, you know, I didn't know I wasn't going back. So I had not said goodbye to Grandma or to anybody, and I think that kind of unfinished business is what connected me. You know, because a lot of times I thought about it, and this only kind of, I figured it out maybe about 10 years ago. I think that unfinished business is what tied me to food. And food for me was a continuous connection to Grandma, to that courtyard, And I loved cooking. I loved smelling because that brought me back to that place. I think, like a lot of people, you know, when they smell food, it makes them feel comfortable and makes them think of home, especially if it is. So I think that my passion for food was really that visceral, that basic. And then I carried it on my whole life.
Wow. So when you're cooking today, you still got that connection. You're thinking all the way back to your grandparents' courtyard and the food that you ate then.
Absolutely, the certain flavors. And I kind of, when I cook, I try to capture from my memories those flavors, those pristine flavors that I recall there. Do I capture them now and then? I think I do. But yes, it's the memory and it's going back. But you know what, Veronica, also, those were kind of days that were lean days. And what I was also, I thought was the respect of food, the respect. You know, when my grandmother kind of wrung the neck of a chicken, every part of the chicken was used, you know, the feet, the head, the innards. And so a real respect for food, not wasting, a respect for the animals, you know. Yes, ultimately they become our food, but, you know, you need to respect for the sacrifice that they make. So, you know, it's a whole one after another. I think that's where my basis lies. And my philosophy about food and what we do is, yes, cooking and flavors, but it goes beyond.
Well, Lydia, let's put that philosophy into action and get a taste of the food now. We have a recipe from your new book. It's posted, by the way, on our Central Time Facebook page. Forgive my pronunciation. Orecchiette with clams
Orecchiette.
And zucchini. Orecchiette.
Orecchiette.
Okay.
Orecchiette, we're going down now to the heel of Italy, which is Puglia, and orecchia is the ear. And this little pasta, which is made from durum wheat, is kind of, you roll the dough, and then you make like a little round, and you stretch it with your thumb on a wooden board, and it becomes like a rough earlobe. And so the orecchiette is the pasta, and the rougher it is, the better it is, you know, because pasta, when it's rough, it's great. And then the recipe is rather simple. So we're talking about clam sauce, which is, you know, a quintessentially Italian recipe, southern Italian. I added a little bit of zucchini here. I thought that, you know, in these days, this is one, because this book has over 400 recipes. And the recipes are from traditional regional Italian recipes, but there are also recipes of the Italian American cuisine, because when I came to America, I got into that one. But there's also some recipes that I innovated to make them more contemporary. And this is one of those recipes. In today, when we are all so concerned, we love pasta, we all love pasta, but we want to eat less of it. So if we add vegetable to it, if we increase proteins to it, we can make this pasta, still enjoy it, eat maybe less pasta, the ratio of pasta to proteins to vegetable about the same. And this is one of those simple recipe that does just that.
We're talking to Lydia Bastianich now about her latest cookbook. It's called Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine. We've got that recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. She's got an event tomorrow in Milwaukee.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes an Italian dish authentic? And what is your favorite Italian dish to prepare? What did you learn from your grandparents or your grandparents about cooking, about food, and what are you doing to pass on that love? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with Lydia Bastianich. She's the author of Mastering the Art of Italian Cooking.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Italian cooking? What is your favorite Italian dish to make or to eat? Is this part of your family's heritage? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find a recipe, by the way, from Lydia on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Julianne on the line from Southwest Wisconsin. Julianne, hi.
Hi. I'm really thrilled to be able to talk with Lydia on the radio. She's one of my favorite chefs to watch on public television.
Thanks, Julianne.
What's your question, Julianne?
I've been hearing a lot of things in the last year or so about olive oils and whether or not the olive oils that we get are really what they say they are. and just wondering what Lydia could suggest as far as how important that is.
Thank you so much for that question. Yeah, I've been hearing that too, that they're often cut with different olive oils, different oils that aren't olive, mm-hmm. that may not be pure. What do you know about that one, Lydia?
Well, Julian, you know, olive oil is, olives are grown around the world in the temperate zone. And I think that, you know, certainly a well-informed consumer, that means reading the labels. But what are you looking for? Now, olive oil, and I can talk about Italian olive oil, certainly. Olive oil, if you look on the label, it needs to say, if it is 100% Italian, produced in Italy, produced and bottled in Italy, not just bottled in Italy, because then you leave it open. So the produced a product of Italy, those are the terminologies that you need to look for. So if it's a back bottle, packaged in Italy or whatever, it's open for all kinds of interpretations and additions. How you judge olive oil? Olive oil is judged by its oleic acid. So from the quality of olive oil. So if you buy an extra virgin olive oil, that means that the oleic acid in that olive oil is from 1 to 0, and that's the best. Then you go to virgin olive oil, it's from 0 to 2. So that's next. And then if it's just regular olive oil, then it's more of the, you know, sort of the oleic acid. So you want to look for the extra virgin or virgin. You want to look that it is a product grown, produced in Italy. And as far as Italian wines, what you, oils, what you also want to look at that makes a good oil is cold pressing. Now, just like wine, you know, flavor molecules attach kind of, you know, to molecules, to fat, and when you add heat to it, the molecules expand and the flavonoids escape. So you lose flavor in wine and even in oil if it's not a cold pressed or a cold fermentation. Just like when you cook in the kitchen, you get these great smells. That's because, you know, the molecules expand, the flavonoids escape, and you smell it good. So you want cold pressed on the bottle itself. Now, as far as Italy, again, there's 20 regions, and every region produces olive oil. How do you choose? Well, the best thing is really to taste and what is good for your palate. But I can generalize somewhat. North Italy, Liguria, or the Lake region, a very buttery oil, light oil. You go in the center, Umbria, Tuscany, a peppery oil. It kind of, when you goes down the throat, there's a kind of a peppery feeling. Mm-hmm. And if you go to southern Italy, where there's the Puglia, Sicily, and all that, a very vegetal oil. That's a very general kind of collection of what oils in Italy taste. So you want to look for the extra virgin. And oil is expensive. Do not buy, if you buy the expensive oil, a big amount, because olive oil oxidizes quickly. That's why it's good for us. It's an antioxidant because it takes in oxygen. So if you buy a quart of good oil, and you're going to pay quite a bit if you get the extra virgin cold press from a producer in one of these regions, a small producer that you can trust, you're going to pay quite a bit. So it's better to buy smaller bottles, keep it in a dry, cool, dark place, and keep it, if you do buy a larger amount, put it in smaller bottles where oxygen will not have access to it, so it won't oxidize on you.
All right, some good
Julian,
advice.
I hope that helps you.
Definitely. Good luck, Julian. I hope that helps. We're talking to Lydia Bastianich on Food Friday today. We'll go to another caller now. Lisa is with us in Oconomowoc. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lydia.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I want to welcome you to Milwaukee. But first of all, just want to tell you that my family has enjoyed watching your cooking show so much. It feels like just we are in your kitchen, and you have schooled me so much from a humble cook from the Midwest to somebody who really models you. I even copy your line just like that.
And Lisa, you have a question for Lydia, I understand.
Yes, Lydia. I wanted to know, what is the difference between iodized salt and sea salt? You're always using sea salt, and I wondered if it's something we should all be investing in.
Lisa, well, thanks.
Salt has its base in the sea, whether it's iodized or not. It's always sea salt, and it's harvested two ways. It is harvested by dehydrating seawater directly, and then that means just evaporating the water part and leaving the salt crystals to be our salt. Or it could be also mined, but that's still, even if it's mined, it's from the sea. At some point, it was deposited there. Now, iodine is naturally existent in sea and hence in the sea salt. But as big industry would have it, they take the salt, they purify it, they change it molecularly so it doesn't stick, so it doesn't, and they deplete it of all of its, if you will, flavors, because if you dehydrate directly the water from the sea, within that, those crystals are little algae particles or little minuscule crustaceans and all of that. That's why sometimes you have gray salt, sometimes you have pink salts, because within that water that has dried, these little particles remain. Now, big industry again purifies all of that out, takes out the iodine, and then re-puts it in once they're finished with taking it out. So if you take straight salt from the sea that hasn't been purified and passed through, you made in fine particles or whatever, you get the iodine naturally in there. They don't need to re-iodine it, whatever, add the iodine to it.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Lydia, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you to everybody.
That was Lydia Bastiana. She's the host of Lydia's Italy on PBS and the author of 10 cookbooks. Her latest is called Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, everything you need to know to be a great Italian cook. And you can find a link to her recipe for orecchiette with clams and zucchini on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can also catch her at the Pabst Theater tomorrow night in Milwaukee.
Groundhog Day is just over 2 weeks away, and one Wisconsin community is racing against the clock to make sure they have the star attraction at their local celebration after a bit of unpleasantness last year.
That's right. You may remember this. Sun Prairie's annual event includes a real-life groundhog who whispers weather predictions into the ear of the mayor. Only last year, things didn't quite go down as planned. Jimmy the groundhog actually bit the mayor's ear, and this was there's video and pictures and everything.
Sun Prairie has a new mayor now because of elections, not because of the groundhog bite. And now it needs a new groundhog, too. The Capital Times reports that after that biting incident and all the international coverage that followed, the keepers of the groundhog were informed that they didn't have the right license to have a groundhog, so they released Jimmy the 11th into the wild.
And now the city says it's negotiating with a wildlife company for a new Jimmy to take the stage next month on February 2nd.
I wouldn't know if I were to suddenly need a live groundhog. Do you go? I don't know if that's in the phone book, if they still make those online Groundhogs or Us, Craigslist. I don't know.
I like the idea of having just a sudden, very acute need for a groundhog. What do? Can you call some overnight Amazon, maybe?
But I believe there are companies, I guess, and this is what they're negotiating with, companies that provide, hopefully, as trained as possible, wildlife and they're licensed to handle these. So I love the event, though. I love that Sun Prairie does this. Yeah. They buy into Groundhog Day. Good luck. I hope you get the groundhog in time.
And hopefully the groundhogs have a good time, too.
Right. And don't bite the mayor. I believe a cage will be involved this time. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.